On episode 10 of Stack Overflow, Joel and Jeff discuss the fine art of listening, source control, the risks of being an internal IT developer, and the state of current mobile platforms. Oh, and how to clean the toilet. From IT Conversations.
Hey, what's up?
Just working on Stack Overflow, the usual things.
Oh, really?
Yes. Contrary to popular opinion, we do actually do work on the project. I know you don't believe me, but it does actually.
What is this project again? It's some kind of a podcast.
Yes, some kind of website we're building.
That reminds me, we should actually probably take some time to explain to some of the new listeners, the IT Conversations listeners who suddenly got our podcast shoveled into their iPods without asking for it, a little bit about what we're building and what the point of the podcast is.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Stack Overflow is a joint venture between me and Joel, where we're trying to combine our communities, our respective sort of programmers and those that love programmers, and actually build a website that serves that community. It's sort of built by them for them, mm-hmm. And it's specifically to address the growing numbers of programmers that aren't really learning programming from reading books anymore. They're learning programming by doing stuff, you know, loading their IDE or, you know, TextMate or whatever they use, and just trying things. And when something doesn't work, they then do a web search to find out, why didn't that work? How can I learn more about this?
Yep.
And so Stack Overflow is really there to feed those searches. And it's not by us, me or you, but really everyone. So as little problems come up, you'll post a question on Stack Overflow, and it's very low friction, very simple website, not a lot of long-term commitments, no sign-up. Very Wikipedia-like in some aspects, and our hope is that you'll find be able to post your question and also find answers to the questions you have while programming on the site.
Cool.
I have my movie pitch. Hold on, my movie pitch, which is it's sort of like
is
Wikipedia.
It the elevator pitch.
It's like that, but I like to call it the movie pitch. Yeah. You know, they always talk about movies. You know, it's like Driving Miss Daisy meets The Predator, right?
Right.
So I'm going to call
it The Graduate. 10 years later.
That's right. So it's like Wikipedia meets blogs meets Reddit / Dig. And also a bit of Experts Exchange, but we have very ambivalent feelings towards Experts Exchange.
You don't want to mention them.
Yes. Sorry. I've already done it.
First of all, they put that annoying hyphen in there. So it used to be Expert Sex Change, and then they put the hyphen in to disambiguate.
Yeah, they should just embrace that identity, I think.
Exactly. You know? That was kind of sort of funny. Yesterday, I had an error message, and I tried typing it in and went to Experts Exchange, and it said the answer is only available if you pay. But, of course, sometimes if you just keep scrolling down, you'll see the answer anyway.
Well, I will say that some of the people at Experts Exchange do have a sense of humor because they actually saw what we were doing, someone did in their community, mm-hmm. and invited me to their conference, which is like in August. And I got to figure out where that is.
Where is
actually.
It? Yeah.
That's kind of important. But I thought I might go because it seems like at least a couple people had, you know, a sense of humor, and they realized, hey, you know, we're not all necessarily competing. It's a very large pie, which is the way I still view it.
You know, a lot of the people that contribute there are going to contribute to our site.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think our site is going to be better because it's going to be very low friction and very simple and clean and just basic. So I think we'll distinguish ourselves that way, if by no other way than that.
We're not going to be selling memberships.
No, we won't be selling you anything. It may eventually be ads, just to be clear, because unlike Wikipedia, this is actually a for-profit venture, but you know, in a very tasteful way is the way I say it, and in a way that serves the community and not fights it.
Right. In an earlier episode, we'd actually talked about trying to make sure that the questions and answers were in some way Creative Commons licensed or something.
CC Wiki is what we're going to use. And actually, somebody emailed me who had grave concerns about how we were going to license, and I emailed them and said, hey, you know, CC Wiki's in the beta. It's in the footer of the beta. And what do you think of that? And I guess he hadn't seen that particular one, but he seemed very encouraged that we were thinking about it and doing something about it. And that's really the intent of these podcasts and the blog and all this other stuff is, and why we talk about it before it's actually available, is we want to get feedback from the community on what it is we're supposed to be building as we build it. And we don't want that to go on too long, obviously. We don't want to have like a Duke Nukem Forever type situation where, you know, it never actually ships. But I don't think we'll have that problem.
That's funny. I was pretty sure that's an excellent opportunity for a rat hole. That Duke Nukem Forever, I've been convinced for the last decade or so that they're just pulling one over on us, pretending that there's another version of Duke Nukem coming out. They're not really doing anything. And every once in a while, just for kicks, they'll leak something somewhere to somebody.
In a way, I'm gonna be disappointed when it ships, because it's become the benchmark for all software of like, well, at least we ship before Duke Nukem Forever. Like the Wine Project. Did you see this was news? The Wine Project, which is like a Windows emulator under Unix.
Yes, they declared that they're 1.0. Yeah, yeah.
That was 15 years.
Really?
15.
Moses.
It's an old project. I remember a friend who worked at Sun. Gosh, this was in like 93. And she was telling me about the Wine Project. And it wasn't a new project then.
There was another one that was made by this company called Bristol Technology. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that? It was like a way to get your code to compile under Unix if it was Windows code.
I don't remember that.
And I don't know what happened to them. I think Microsoft sued them into oblivion. Because, I don't know, let's look up Bristol on the web.
I don't know that one, but I know Wine
is Bristol.
It's probably not the best search term to use.
Wow. They're just gone.
That's what happens when Microsoft doesn't like you, man. They're just gone.
They were bought by, they were acquired by HP, but it looks like they've long since given up their original product, which was kind of like a commercial version of Wine, essentially.
Ah, I see.
Okay, let's see. Do we have something to talk about? Just to conclude, then, what this podcast is for those of you that are new to the podcast is since Jeff and I are on opposite coasts. Jeff is on the left coast, and I am on the correct coast. We meet virtually every week by having about an hour-long phone conversation just to check up on the status and talk about any design questions that may have come up or things that are going on with Stack Overflow, and just generally just to chat, you know. And we thought it'd be fun, as long as we're having these weekly phone conversations, to start recording them, which is what we did. In the first episodes, you can actually hear they sound like phone calls. We've since switched to Skype, which has higher audio quality.
And you're using you're using a new fancy mic, right?
I'm using one of these like fancy radio broadcaster mics.
Awesome.
I can't hear the difference.
I can hear it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely can. Because there was a little bit of breath noise on the other one. But it sounds better.
That's true. We've also eliminated the air conditioning noise that was it's pretty loud in our office.
Yes. So I also have I wanted to make a confession. So the way this works is we record them, and then I listen to them and actually make semi-detailed notes about sort of what we talked about. And some I like to hyperlink a bunch of stuff so that people who don't want to listen or just want to see the topics can follow along. And plus, I find it useful as well to go.
Yeah, I think that's incredibly useful, the show notes.
Yeah. So I want to make a confession. So as I'm listening to the show, I realize that, and I've gotten better with this, and I think there's other reasons this happens, I realize I'm not hearing everything you say. This is probably not a revelation to people who realize listening is really hard. And in my defense, a lot of times, like, I don't want there to be dead air as we're talking, so I'm trying to cue up things I want to say so that there's not some long pause while I think about, oh, what should I say next? So that's my defense.
If you're not listening to me.
Well, it's strange. I would hear you say stuff like, wow, after the fact, and we go, wow, I totally did not hear Joel say that.
I'm just going to have a test. There's going to be a test at the end of this episode.
But no, listening is hard. I mean, I think that's really the lesson is, like, do you really listen to people? It was really kind of shocking to me when I did that, and I've really tried to do better because I was shocked. I was like, how can I not be listening to someone who's talking to me? But I think you'd be surprised. I mean, just recording yourself and listening to it this way is a little bit shocking in what goes on. And I have improved. I've noticed that it happens less often where you'll say something and go, wow, I wish I had heard that the first time because I would have responded to it. So that's my confession of this particular podcast. We have a lot of progress on the project, so there's a number of things I can talk about there. How many questions do we have queued up?
Okay, let's see. Wait, you were saying something, but I wasn't listening. How many questions do we have queued up? I got three.
Okay.
And also, well, I've also queued up this. So if you want to tell any jokes, I got a rim shot all set up.
Okay, please. We're only going to do that once ever, right? That was the one time. And yeah, I guess I asked for that.
There's a website you can go to.
Yeah, that's great. Great. So now it's like a morning show.
It's called
show,
instant,
you know?
InstantRimShot.com. It's just got a big, gigantic red button right in the middle. And when you click it, you get, isn't that awesome? If you ever need that really quickly.
That's great. We can't do that enough. I think we should have a whole show where that's
all
we do. There's a site like that. Those are called single-serving websites. Websites that you go to have very, very – that's one thing they do, and it's ridiculously simple. There's a site like that, but it does that sound. Which I find much funnier, actually. My wife told me she used to work with someone, and they talked about the transition sound between this person's slide should be that mwah, 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 because it's their presentations were so bad that that would have been wholly appropriate for that person. So let's talk about Stack Overflow and what's going on. So first of all, we did have a beta site up, and very clever hacker listeners figured out the URL for our site, not that it's very difficult to figure out. And we're actually interacting with the site. Now, normally I would actually welcome this, and I you know, don't get me wrong, I think it's very cool that you guys are interested and engaged and want to help us, but the site is really not fit for human consumption at the moment, in that we're rebuilding the database like pretty much daily.
How come I can't figure it out?
I don't know. Are you – maybe, you know, this is like one of those tests you talk about in your book. Maybe you're failing your own – you wouldn't hire yourself at this point.
What is – what? It's not beta.stackoverflow.com.
It is. That was what it was, but I moved it because
people were figuring
out. And this is really for your own protection. I mean, I want to wait until the public beta private beta.
Okay, coming
up.
What was your blog post about this week on coding R? Not that you only had one, but – what was your blog? Let me ask specifically.
The one that you actually
June 14th, 2008. And the headline of which was,
is it the one
Don't Go Dark.
Well, I thought that was, yeah, you commented there. And I was like, that was a little unfair.
Oh,
because
really?
Have we really been dark? We have this podcast. We have a blog where we talk about we're doing. We're not really dark. Dark is like dark. Dark is like just a void where there's no idea what's going on. And I don't think that's fair to characterize that way. But anyway, I do appreciate the interest. And actually, anybody who found the beta site legitimately, email me because I will give you a special badge, a hacker badge.
Oh,
that will be on your profile on the real site once we have the private betas, which I thought you might find fun. And enjoyable.
We don't need no stinking badges.
I think the badges are fun. I think people will see how they work, and they're completely optional. You can just ignore them if you don't
badges?
Like them. I know the movie you're referring to. That's the Sierra Madre, Treasure of the Sierra Madre.
And it's one of those things that they never really say that the way you – you know, they never actually say that.
Right.
It's a
misremembered quote.
Let's see. The official quote is, badges, we don't need no stinking badges.
Yeah.
It's, I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
Yes. So the badges, the way we're viewing them, are complementary to your reputation score. And all this is, again, optional. You can ignore it. But it's for a way that for people that are participating in the system. The only importance it will have to people is you will not be able to treat the site like a wiki and actually edit everything until you get enough reputation in the system. So we're like Wikipedia in that you can edit everything, but we're unlike Wikipedia in that you have to earn that ability a little bit. By participating in the system normally for
a while. That's awesome.
And then after the system trusts you, it'll say, okay, you can do this because you've participated.
Yeah.
I think it's a good balance because we'll still have anonymous participation, to be clear. Anonymous people will be able to ask and answer questions, no problem. They just can't edit because we view edit as kind of a privileged operation.
I think this is going to be terrific.
Yeah, I think it's a nice compromise. I mean, I think it's a nice, sweet middle ground that will work well. So we've done a lot of work around build. Well, technically, Jared, one of my coworkers on this project, did a tremendous job on getting our build up and running. So we actually have a build script now that's checked into source control. So we can pass the Joel test. We can do a one-step build that deploys the database, the code, and actually even does unit tests. Jared went way above and beyond. One of the advantages of the MVC framework, it's really easy to write unit tests for this site because everything is URL. Like every action is a URL. There's not a lot of postback stuff going on. So we actually have, as part of the build, it deploys the database, deploys the code, and then it actually creates users, you know, and that's just, again, URL-based, and actually creates questions.
Don't you have to be a little careful to make sure that, like, those URLs aren't things that search engines and Google spiders and stuff will accidentally hit? Like, if you've got a button that's like, click here to delete all posts in this area, and then a search engine comes along and clicks it while it's downloading copies of everything because it thinks it's just a link.
Yeah, I think that's not usually a problem. I mean, I think as much as the web is, you know, just a random motley assortment of code, I think that would be happening.
It's not a problem if it's behind a form or something, but like sometimes you have a temptation to. I think that's why there's this general rule that a hyperlink should never take an action.
Right.
Only form submits should take actions because the spiders will never try to fill in a form.
Well, it's not that we don't have some postbacks. I think there are some postbacks, but they're greatly reduced relative to the typical ASP.NET programming model. The, you know, pretend we're on a Windows
and
form
it's a
model.
GUI and VB.
Yeah. So I think it's not entirely that way, but just enough so that the development, I think, becomes simpler. And one manifestation of that is these unit tests. And it was cool, actually, last night I had added a field to the database, and I couldn't get it to deploy, and I wasn't really thinking about what was happening, and Jeff, another developer, looked at it because I wanted to have another pair of eyes on it. And he's like, oh, you're failing this unit test. And that actually blocked the rest of the deployment, which made total sense.
Hey,
yeah, I know. It was very cool. So I want to give Jared credit for doing that because first I was like, why are we wasting our time on – I love tests, but I'm not a test-first guy. I just don't get that religion. I view it as you want to have some of the site running, then sort of add your tests in after you have sort of a minimum level of basic functionality.
Well, of course, the temptation.
That's definitely.
I was talking to – who was I talking to about this yesterday? You? Anyway, some.
It wasn't me.
There's a real tendency the one thing that all developers in the world have in common is that they will tell you that the code base they're working on sucks and it's a big mess, and if they were only working someplace else that was more professional, the code would be nice and whatever. And there's a real tendency whenever you're doing any kind of project, no matter how large, how small, how much code, whether it's like 15 minutes of code that you're going to write right now or a day of code or a week of code, to do it in two phases. And in the first phase, you say, let me just get it working. Because if I don't have something working, then there's no point if it's good or not. I'm going to do the minimum. And you really want to get that reward of getting something up and running and seeing it working. And then you can come back and make it fast, and you can improve the algorithm, and you can polish things, and you can restructure the code so it's clean. And there is just a real tendency, and that's when you start to use cut and paste code and all kinds of the anti-patterns from that great book called Anti-Patterns. I don't know if that's on my list, but all the things that you do to just get it working that you think you'll clean up later. And then the joke is you never come back and clean them up later. And that's not because you're a failure as a human being, although you might be. But that's not why you're not doing those other things. You're not doing those other things because once you have it working, they suddenly seem a lot less interesting to you. You're like, you know, I got a few pages of code. I don't even have to look at it anymore because the code now works. Like, why should I even worry about that? In fact, it occurred to me, and I started to notice this phenomenon with code that I wrote on Thursday. I try to make like at least a day every week or two in which I literally do not open my email or web browser and just try to take a day and write code. Otherwise, I would never get any code written. And what I was writing actually is a little utility for the internal salespeople here at Fog Creek to use to generate coupons, which is 99% of the coupons are somebody asking for an educational discount on our software. So we give them a coupon. So we used to have this horrible way of doing it, and I made a good way of doing it. And basically, somewhere in there, the data structure works like this in the database. There's a row for each coupon, and then for every coupon, it may cause various discounts to be applied to various products. So like, I give you a coupon that's worth 50% off on Fogbugs for Windows, 50% off on Fogbugs for Macintosh, 50% off on Fogbugs for Unix, 30% off on Copilot, or whatever the case may be. So that's obviously a one-to-many relation. And so I got to insert one record in the coupon table, and then I got to get the ID of that record and insert a whole bunch of records in the coupon line of coupon table, all using that ID. And I was actually doing this from code, and as I was doing this, it suddenly occurred, I was doing this by having two separate blocks of C# code, the code that inserts the coupon and then the code that gets the newly inserted ID and creates all those other rows. And I suddenly realized I could do this all from a single SQL statement, or maybe not one statement, but the statements could be merged into one call. And that would make what is now about a page of code become about half a page of code, and it'd just be cleaner and nicer. Did I do it? No. Because I got the thing working, and then I went home. And there's just no reason ever to open up that code again. But if anybody does open it up, they're going to say, why didn't he?
Well, you don't have anybody reviewing the code, do you?
That helps.
You don't have multiple steps.
Nobody.
It helps tremendously. I mean, that's why I was really glad to add Jeff to the team, because working with another developer is really big.
Yeah.
Just, the value of having four eyes versus two.
Oh, yeah. And this isn't, to be fair, this is not really quote-unquote production code. This isn't code that we're trying to sell to somebody. It doesn't have to last very long. It's just a tool for our internal salespeople to use. Once it works, and this is one of the things that I think people find depressing when they work in internal IT instead of working at a product company as software developers. It can be real depressing because once you get the code working, the business case for spending any more time on it evaporates. It's like, we can now make coupons. So why are you concerned about whether there's one SQL call or two SQL calls there? So don't even obsess about it.
Well, yeah, time to refactor, because that is true. I mean, you move on to the next project, you're done. But is code really done? When is code done?
You could sit there and you could polish that little piece of code till the end of eternity. You make the world's best, but it would not improve your salespeople's ability to make coupons, and therefore there's no business case for it, and it's a waste of time. On the other hand, if you make a company that's like the coupon company, and that's your whole business, is making it really easy to make coupons. I don't even know what that means. But let's say this code is a part of a product, then every time I make it better, I'm going to improve my customers' happiness and therefore sell more copies. So when you're writing production code that you're going to sell, or code for the marketplace, or even like working on a website that the whole world's going to see, like you guys are, anything, Stack Overflow, Google, whatever, every time you make that code better, you make your business more successful. Whereas when it's that secondary support code that's being used for some internal payroll application, it just has to get good enough. And then there is no return on investment for any further work. So I think the people in IT departments are just really depressed, or eventually they get kind of frustrated, because there's a real strong business argument for them just not to work very hard or make their code very nice.
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the key pieces of advice I think a lot of people eventually arrive at as a software developer, is if you really love this stuff, you have to work somewhere where software is the product. It's the thing you're trying to deliver to the customer. Because if you don't, then you're invariably going to get frustrated with the model. And I think that's natural. And I think you just have to realize what kind of developer you are. Are you, just the kind of guy who does it 9-to-5, it's your job, you don't really want to take it home with you? Or is it like everything in your life, like it is for me, which is a little disturbing? Then you definitely want to work for a software company. And I think that's a key decision you have to make. And I've certainly given people that advice before, mm-hmm. That I identified as developers who really just love the process of coding. It kind of destroys you inside after a while if you can't give the code the love that you feel it mm-hmm. needs. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a completely valid point. And it's been brought up. I know you've brought it up, and it remains totally valid.
My time in industry was working at Viacom. And so I worked on websites for MTV, the Sundance Channel, Blockbuster. Viacom is just this big holding company that owns all these other media companies. MTV is the most famous one. The code that I was writing there, I just remember getting something that they wanted. Somebody wanted an automated FTP. And I wrote this totally overkill, elegant system for synchronizing two directories using FTP from a laptop to a server. And then launching some kind of a content management system in the background. And it was just it was totally overkill, and they appreciated that. But then I documented it, and I made a setup application, and I made an administrative tool, and I made six different manuals, depending on what your role was in using this thing. You had a custom written manual that described exactly how you worked with this tool. And nobody ever once looked at those. And the only reason I even did that is because I was basically underemployed there and just had nothing to do most of the day. So, so I sat around polishing these things. And it was sort of frustrating to me that absolutely nobody ever looked at it or used it or ran the code. But then they certainly didn't appreciate the overkill that went into creating the promotional website, the internal promotional website for the tool or the documentation or the setup apps or anything like that.
Right. And that's the interesting thing about your history is because I always think of Joel as the Joel on software Joel. But if you look at your history, it's really interesting. You followed in the footsteps, I think, a lot of typical developers who come up through just, you know, internal IT. You had jobs like that. And it's so hard for me to imagine you in that role.
You know, I used to have to
wash dishes. Doing just internal line of business apps. Yeah, pretty much. You were like peeling the programming equivalent of peeling potatoes.
No, but I actually did peel potatoes. I didn't peel that many potatoes. Onions. When you peel onions, ugh. I worked in the when I was in the Israeli army, I just spent months working in the I don't want to say dining room because it was a tent with mud floors in the desert. And my job was setting the table and washing the dishes, clearing the table, setting the table, washing the dishes, and that was like 18 hours a day. Setting tables, clearing tables, washing dishes.
You know, it's interesting. A lot of your military – I've been meaning to bring this up, and I guess we might as well since we're on it. Your military background has been really fertile ground for you for writing. And it was always interesting to me because one of your favorite posts that you wrote was about learning how to clean the toilet when the starched, super clean lieutenant or whatever rank – sergeant said, this is how you clean a toilet. Mm-hmm. And then he proceeded to get down on his knees and clean the toilet. And you were like, wow. And I was like, that's such a powerful
It really was. No, but I fell in love with that guy. Oh, my leadership. God. What a great guy. I was just like.
I mean, no, that's leadership.
I would have gone to the end of
I've actually saw another anecdote. Yeah, that was similar where somebody had spilled something on the floor and like the CEO of the company comes over and starts cleaning it up, right? Because the lesson is everybody takes responsibility for everything that happens. Just because you're the CEO doesn't mean you get a pass on, doing the things that need to be done. And that's I love that story. And
it's not just that; it also
makes me
like for that CEO. It's like I am not above you. I'm not some special person that needs to be spoon fed that can't clean up his own spills. And also, you guys are the start. Like we really do draw our org charts upside down at Frog Creek, and we see quote unquote management as just being here to support people. And in fact, I was talking to somebody who was recently promoted to be the team lead of Fog Bugs. Who was talking to me today, and he's like, he mentioned something which he thought was kind of frustrating, which was that a lot of times when there are like little emergencies that just need to be fixed, like, oh, there's a little bug here in some old version of some code. You got to check out that old version, fix it, get it deployed to these four customers, whatever. These just like little emergencies erupt all the time. And he winds up doing all that stuff. And the reason is because at Fog Creek, we totally recognize that we want our developers to be able to concentrate on one thing and just come in and concentrate on that thing and never get interrupted and not have to multitask. And the only way to make that happen in the real world when there's all kinds of little emergencies cropping up all the time is that the emergencies get handled by the managers so that the people can do their job, no matter how grubby the emergencies are. And if you look at what me and Michael do here, it's just a lot of like ad hoc, like literally right now I'm making decisions about the benches that will go in the coffee bar for our new office. Stuff that you would think like, hey, why don't you delegate that stuff and think about the big picture? But the whole reason I'm not delegating that stuff is so that the staff here can concentrate on just doing one thing, whatever that their thing may be. The salespeople can do sales and the developers can do development. So an interesting part about saying our hierarchy is upside down, management is a support function. It's there to support the developers doing their jobs. Mean that as you get promoted into management, you're going to find that you're the person that has to do all those little cleanup jobs and all those little emergencies that crop up so that the developers can have kind of the luxury of just doing whatever their main, multi-month project is without it.
I think that's a great way to look at it. And the way I've described it, which I think is similar, is your job as a manager is to throw yourself on grenades to protect me from being interrupted or having to go to these pointless meetings that you have to go to. And I always told him, I was like, I do not envy your job, like in the slightest. I was like, it's you're doing the things that I don't want to have to be bothered doing. But I think that understanding the whole, preventing them from being interrupted and, is the core lesson. And I think
it's pretty hard, and it's gonna. You guys are sort of already doing it with Stack Overflow, but I remember the early days of Fog Creek when we were literally two people. It was me and Michael, and we would just take turns doing everything else so that one person could sit and write code. So there was a big block of time when I just did literally everything at Fog Creek except for what Michael was doing, and Michael was writing. Let's see, what was he doing? At one point, he was writing the store, the online store. Then at one point, I actually went through Fogbugs line by line and cleaned it all up to make it like code that would last for 1,000 years instead of code that was sort of kind of able to work. And I think much of that structure still exists. And but anyway, the point is that while we were doing this, the other person was doing literally everything else. And one of the things I discovered is like a sort of a small business when you're operating, when you have it, all the features that a small business has, including customers, that's at least 50 to 60% of one person's time is the overhead of maintaining the fact that you are a business. I don't even, I'm not sure what stuff is. Well,
I term some of what I do is now as crowd control, mm-hmm. basically, where I'm trying to respond to emails and, you know, manage the comments and basically deal with my online presence. Mm-hmm. And that does take some time, but it's something that, you know, Jared and Jeff hopefully don't have to worry about.
Well, that's your number one contribution is, you know, I would call it, I put that in the category of PR, basically, is in some way gaining, making people aware that we have this thing and that we're working on. And
Well, that's why it was ironic you left that comment about PR, because that's pretty much the opposite of everything that I do. I think you just are really chomping at the bit to see the site, which you will be able to. I'm going to give you the other secret URL now, which maybe someone will figure that one out too. I don't know. security through obscurity at the same time.
Oh, okay. I know what it is. It's probably like codinghorror.stackoverflow.com.
Secret.stackoverflow. Yeah, who knows? Someone will probably write a dictionary attack and break it in like minutes.
Wait, can I just query and find out what all is there?
I don't know if you can. I don't know, actually. I mean, I know how I set up the prefixes.
Yeah.
I don't know. We'll see. I mean, like I said, I don't mind people coming to see the site. It's really for your own protection. I mean, if people want to see it, that's totally cool with me. It's just it's sort of actively hostile to human life at this moment. So if you're into that, then, you know, please.
A website that was actually like literally hostile to human life? I mean, they could have – well, first of all, you'd want to have flashing because at least you can get the epileptics to go into a seizure. So there's a minimum.
Well, those sites – you're joking, but those sites actually exist. I mean, pretty much there's sites that try to game you. They're like, download this video codec to look at this video of who knows what, right? But it's an EXE, which has, you know,
and then there's one
and payloads.
There's
a lot of evil.
They're like, can you see the ghost in this picture? And you're like staring and staring. You're like, no, where is it? And then like the whole picture changes to like a screaming person.
Yeah. I've gotten bitten by those before. And then you feel like a doofus. You're like, I feel like a total idiot now. So, yeah. So another thing I want to talk about briefly is we are using Subversion for source control, which I view as a good default choice. I mean, it's free. It's pretty good. There's things that kind of freak me out about Subversion, having used a few other source control systems, but it's certainly good at the
very
least.
What freaked you out of?
And there's parts of the model that I find unsatisfying. I think it's just about source control in general, because I've started to learn a little bit about distributed version control and how that works.
Yeah, Git and Mercurial, two big ones right now.
And really, the key point to take away there is not that, okay, it's this radical new model, but they make branching and merging trivially easy. And branching and merging in Subversion are so painful, both technologically and from a UI standpoint. And that's huge, because I view one of the main benefits of source control is this whole having parallel universes run alongside each other, where you can explore different techniques. You know, you have a padded room where you can do stuff safely and then, you know, merge back into reality.
Wait, you don't have to have a padded room, you don't have to have a branch. You just have to have your own checkout, and you act like you're in a little padded room. And then if you don't like what happened, then you just delete it and check, you know, go back to what's in the repository.
Well, that's right. And you're hitting on one of the key tenets of distributed version control, which is that when you're working locally, quote unquote, you would still be under version control.
Right.
just implicitly.
Right. And that's the trouble with CVS is like while you're in that padded room, you're just on your hard drive.
That's right. And see, in distributed version control, you're actually still under version control at that point. So you have a total record of every little thing that you did. It's a great model, but really the mindset of making branching and merging easy is the thing I object to. The thing that Subversion does not do very well. And I think the UI like of Tortoise, which is what most people use, the file system shell extension, is not still kind of a programmer UI. And I mean that in the negative.
But I mean, it is a programming tool. I mean, the truth is I find that the UI...
It is.
Yeah. The Tortoise is an awesome tool. On the other hand, you're going to have to learn four or five important concepts, and you're really going to have to get how this thing works before you can start with it. And Tortoise does not relieve you. I don't think any GUI would ever relieve you of that necessity to understand what it is that a source code control system is going to do for you until you understand what operations is doing, which is kind of hard and kind of theoretical and very abstract in a way. So it takes a while to get it.
Source control is tough. I mean, it's definitely I view it as the bedrock of software engineering. And to truly understand source control, particularly once you get into branching and merging and some of the more advanced things that you really should be doing, it is not easy to understand that stuff. Because in my previous job, I basically had to teach that stuff to software developers. And it's not easy to teach that stuff to people. And it's not easy to actually even understand it. So you can sort of empathize.
It's pretty confusing. And so I don't think, I think Tortoise, no GUI is going to make this thing simple for people to understand. Even when you consider just backups, think about like Time Machine, the Apple's Time Machine user interface for backups, which is not exactly source control because it's linear, but you know, it's a little bit like it. And even that is that GUI is barely useful for making it comprehensible to people, but it still can be kind of a confusing subject.
Well, I think there's a way of iteratively doing this where if you have any skill at UI, and I think a lot of the people, particularly some of the people working on Tortoise, I suspect have not a lot of skill in that area. No offense to the Tortoise people, because it is a free tool. I mean, I'm complaining about things I'm getting for free, which is kind of unfair. Yeah. But I feel like you can polish it, absolutely. You have that FAQ model. If you say, okay, what are the top three issues that people run into using Tortoise or Subversion? And you would feed those back into the products. Like how, from a UI perspective, can we ameliorate these problems, and then you would have that feedback loop. And I feel like they haven't gone very far down that path. But again, it's free, and it's much better than, say, SourceSafe, which I have a whole set of blog entries about. Please do not use SourceSafe. So if you're listening to this and you're using SourceSafe, please explore the alternatives, because SourceSafe kind of will poison your mind in that it is very, very old source control system and architecturally does not reflect anything remotely resembling modern source control, which is really
We should mention Tortoise SVN, the person who wrote that code, Stefan Kung, is a guy in Switzerland. He's a very brilliant programmer, really nice guy, and it's just all him. I don't think there's people will send in bug fixes and stuff, but I think he does it's pretty much his project.
Right, and I apologize for coming across.
No, that's okay. It's an awesome tool. Now, the developers on FogBugs or Fog Creek in general recently insisted on switching to Mercurial.
That's
a distributed version control system. Right now, the two contenders are Git and Mercurial, and they are how can I put it? They're kind of 1.0 products, and if you thought source code control is complicated, as soon as it becomes distributed, you gain new powers, but you do so at the cost of extra steps and new abstractions that you have to keep track of. And it could be even more confusing to use something like a distributed source control and to really get it right. So there is kind of an uphill battle there. And I think that Subversion is probably reasonable for small projects where you just don't want to – maybe they're more casual projects. The thing about Mercurial is it's the kind of thing that, like, unless you do it all the time, every day, and you're constantly branching and merging for various important reasons, and maybe you are physically distributed, like you literally are trying to work offline on a code base and then resync up later. Unless you have all those reasons for using it, you're probably, if you use it casually, you're going to forget how it works from one time to the next. So my experience has been that, if I can spend a day a week working on code, and that's when I'm lucky, I also have to keep referring back to my notes of what the main commands are in Mercurial, because it's just like there are a few too many concepts there for me to keep track of in my head all at once. And if you do it regularly, you'll get it. But yeah.
Well, I think you're right. Those are new tools. And I think there's a huge opportunity there for someone to come in and build a really nice GUI, you know, an Apple-style GUI around this stuff. Because I still believe with the right GUI, you can attack these tough concepts and make them easier to break down and comprehend.
The biggest problem, I mean...
With that in mind, I was going to mention one tool that helped me tremendously with Subversion was Visual SVN, which is a Visual Studio add-in. Since I work in Visual Studio mostly... it sort of brings me the Subversion experience in Visual Studio. So I don't have to, you know, tab out to the file system to do operations. And I have sort of one-click operation to see, you know, what pending changes have I made. Mm-hmm. And it just really helps me understand the model, because I'm viewing it more from the lens of not, okay, here's a bunch of crap in the file system, but here's my project in Visual Studio. And here's the current state of it in source control. So that helped me tremendously. I definitely recommend, if you're in Visual Studio, Visual SVN, people had recommended it, and they were right. It totally changed my attitude.
Didn't there used to be this problem that that Visual Studio's understanding of source code control systems, Visual Studio assumed that they were check-in models?
Only in 2003. Oh. As of 2005, because of Team System, because the way Team System is a very modern source control system. I mean, love it or hate it, it's definitely modern. And 2005, they changed the model completely. So that was only true of 2003 and earlier.
Cool. For those of you that don't know what we're talking about, there's basically two philosophies of centralized source code control. There's the philosophy that is used by Visual Source Safe, Perforce most of the time, that says before an RCS, says before you can work on something, you need to check it out, and then it's yours, and you make your changes, and then you check it in again. And then there's the simpler system that CVS and Subversion use that says if you want to work on something, just start working on it. Just start editing the file, and later you can decide to try to merge your changes in with everybody else's changes, but you don't really like own or lock out the file. And so in particular, the way the early versions of Visual Studio did their integration, I guess, in their first few 17 iterations of the IDE, the way they integrated it with these source control systems is that they would take care of like checking out a file for you. If you opened a file and started editing it, they'd be like, all right, let me go check that out for you. And that is an operation that was not really necessary in CVS or Subversion. And so it was hard in the old days to write appropriate plugins for Visual Studio for CVS or Subversion.
I will say that as a developer, spend a lot of time learning source control. It will serve you as well as any other computer science concept you can learn. It is really that fundamental, and I meet so few developers that really get it. I mean, I feel like I don't truly get all of it, but I've gone further than most because I was teaching other developers, so I sort of had to learn it in more detail. But yes, please, if you hear this and get motivated to learn more, and it doesn't really matter what you choose, just choose something modern like... Here's ones that I like that I've heard good things about. So Subversion, definitely. It's free. It's, you know, a lot of default choice for good reason. Perforce, a lot of people really like Perforce. Team System, it has a server-connected model, which can be kind of a bummer, which means you have to be always connected, which a lot of people don't. But other than that, it actually is very good once you learn that and deal with that. And they're changing the model a little bit to deal with that. A lot of people are saying, well, I want to work totally disconnected, et cetera, et cetera. So for some reason, somebody in the architecture division decided early on that it would be fully connected all the time.
What on earth?
They're just basically living with the consequences of that decision from now on. But there are things that are really nice about it, and it's far, far better than source safe.
Yeah.
And I think on par with Subversion, minus the architectural difference of always being connected. Those are the three that I see get mentioned a lot. And then, of course, the new hot distributed version control systems, which are Git and Mercurial, are also worth learning and understanding how they work. So I think those are the key takeaways there. So before we go too much further, I want to get to the questions because I want to run out of time.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's infinite time. We can just grow old together here. What do we want to talk about? Let's you know what? I'm going to take this one first.
Hello, gentlemen. My name is Sebastian Dwornik of Applied PDA Software, and I'm located just outside Toronto, Canada. I'm very interested in your opinions of what you think about the current platform wars going on within the handheld mobile space. I mean, from the iPhone and Windows Mobile to Android, BlackBerry, and Symbian, it all seems quite familiar compared to the last great platform wars of the great desktop space. Do you think Microsoft can rule the handheld mobile space as well? Might this be one area that maybe Apple actually becomes a threat for dominance instead? Or will Google step in from the left and surprise everyone? It's no doubt an exciting time, and I'm really curious to hear what you think about it. Thank you.
Well, with Google, that would be Android, I suppose.
Yeah, I've sort of started to get what Google is doing with Android, because they really are building more of an open ecosystem. Because I do like the Apple model, and I think the iPhone 2 is very strong. It's the product that iPhone V1 should have been, and I think it's going to really well. And I like their App Store. I think they have the right ideas about a lot of this stuff for that closed ecosystem, which handheld platforms are just closed ecosystems sort of by necessity.
No, why is that necessary?
But
Why?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Android is trying to poke a hole in that. So that's the Apple model. Apple's just saying, okay, this is our model. We totally get this. We're going to – it's lock-in, but a lock-in –
it's the famous walled garden. And
But people like
Apple. That's like the people saying that people like the – remember AOL in the old days where there it couldn't go to websites? It had its own version of websites. It had its own content, and there were like these Go keywords. And if you wanted to be a content provider with Apple, you had to go to Virginia and sign a contract with them and all that kind of stuff. And then you provided this content, and they gave you a little bit of money if anybody looked at your content, which is cool until the people stopped paying per byte. And then they stopped giving the content providers the money. And then all of a sudden, everybody realized that this was this dorky walled garden that had about one millionth of what was on the internet, because who can be bothered to go to Virginia and make that deal?
But the thing is, within the mobile phone ecosystem, you're always going to be in a walled garden, because none of the providers who own the towers are going to let you.
Well, that is the problem, of course, is that the providers have managed. And I think this may be unique to the United States, not unique to the United States, but this is a particular implication of the way that the triopoly has developed here.
I think I expect Apple to do very well. I mean, this is a model that they have, done very well with the iPod. It's a very similar model. They have a great product, right? People like their product. It does things that people want. It's reasonably priced now. I expect them to become very dominant, actually. I would expect them to roll over Windows Mobile. Windows Mobile is like a crushing disappointment to me. Apple has had 6 versions to get that right so far, and it's so far from being right. It's almost comical. I mean, not really a bright spot in the Microsoft portfolio. If you look at Xbox, it's sort of a bright spot of, okay, they did a bunch of things right. Windows Mobile, I think, is an example where they did
I think,
many
you know what, the
wrong.
Fun of the very first thing that they did that was wrong. Actually, they did a few things that were wrong. But they made 2 critical mistakes. The first one was that they learned something from user interface design, which is true, which is that the more consistent you are in user interface design, the less likely people are going to be able to figure out your user interface, because if it works the same way as something else that they already know, they don't have anything new to learn, and they'll try that and they'll be able to do it. So when all else fails, if you can't figure out how to make something easy, if you could figure out somehow how to make it consistent with something else, then it may be easier to use. And so they all of a sudden decided that there has to be a start button in the bottom left-hand corner. And Windows, every version of Windows CE has had this particular bug of trying to be like just a small desktop.
Yeah, it's horrible. I agree.
And that's kind of that's their fundamental first wrong mistake. The second mistake they made is that the PC was so successful for Microsoft, this model of letting somebody else make the hardware and let a million different hardware vendors compete. And let's see who can come up with the very, very best thing. It worked great on PCs because everybody was making IBM clones. And there was a minimum bar of, the VGA screen and a keyboard with dedicated cursor keys and so on and so forth that meant that you could write pretty good apps for it. But as soon as they tried to do this on the phone platform, there was such wild variety in the resolution of the screens, the size of the screens, the color depth, the type of input devices that you used, whether there was a keyboard there or not, that it became the dramatic differences between Windows Mobile running on one device versus another make it so that it's really just kind of a big mess, like all kinds of different devices and stuff like that. And this, theoretically, in the PC world, they were just competing on speed, cost, maybe resolution of the screen, size of the hard drive. But on in the handheld market, you've got these vendors like Samsung and LG and I don't know who else makes Windows handhelds, all sort of tripping over themselves to try to somehow create BlackBerry, to try to create these is there a BlackBerry Windows device? No, Trio. Tripping over themselves to create these new and unique devices, and they're just inventing new user interface metaphors and all that kind of stuff. And it makes Windows Mobile a very disjoint experience. It's just different on every device. So half the time, if you find a little piece of Windows Mobile software that you download, you suddenly realize that, you know, you don't have a big enough screen, or you don't have the little touch stylus thingamajiggy that you need to operate the software.
Right. Yeah, well, so my hope, I think, with Android, and I can't really speak about the other phone platforms because I don't know them very well. I know there are others, particularly in Europe and outside the U.S., but my hope is Google's Android will be like Windows Mobile, but without all the sucking. Like, it's an somewhat open ecosystem, and they're rebooting from they're building it from the ground up. And that's the problem, I think, with Microsoft's approach. They really need to raise it to the ground and just say, you know what, this totally isn't working. It's kind of like what they did with Zune, where Zune is actually pretty good. People mock the Zune, but the software and the hardware is actually pretty darn good. It's just they're so entrenched they can't make any progress. But they did the right thing on Zune, even though most people laugh at it. They need to do something similar for mobile, and maybe Android will end up being what Microsoft should have done on the mobile platform, e.g. start from scratch. So I'm really encouraged, although I think Apple's going to be dominant, and because they have a good product and they're doing the right things in their walled garden, my hope is Android will give them some strong competition and be more open, as much as you can be on a phone.
So I'm willing to go out on a limb and make a prediction here based on nothing, knowing nothing about anything. My prediction is that this is going to be like the KDE of telephones. It's going to be the usual open source mishmash. It's going to be way too much configurability. There's going to be competing window managers that you have to download your favorite window manager. And the best programmer is going to work on the window manager that uses the Emacs key bindings. And it's just going to be like not a phone for human beings to use. And it's always going to be very appealing to the top 1% of all nerds who are going to find this thing incredibly cool because, you know, look, I've got Wumpus running in a Xterm. and yet, compared to Apple, because of its open sourceness, there are going to be all kinds of people making all kinds of contributions, and everybody will say, "Oh, but they volunteered. We should include their contribution." And there's just going to be some really good stuff and some really, really, really bad stuff. And some of the really important stuff is going to be really, really bad, and it's going to be inconsistent with some other good stuff that came from someone else. And it's going to have a page of preferences and dot files that you have to fill out to get anything to work in any kind of reasonable way. And it's just going to be a hacker's paradise, and it's just not going to be a useful phone because it's, you know, inconsistency.
I think there is a risk of that, but I would point to like the EPC as an example of where that ecosystem can actually work. And I think I'm more optimistic than you. I agree that's definitely a risk.
Have you seen any EPC?
I think I'm more optimistic. Well, I've read the reviews and seen the screenshots.
For a while it looks okay, and then all of a sudden you realize that it's just kind of a mishmash of Unix software onto the, you know, that it has the same inconsistencies and things not working right, and fonts not looking very good. And
right. That's fair. I haven't actually hands-on.
One of the things I like about Apple, which I should mention actually while we're talking about mobile platforms, and what I like about iPhone, is that they always seem to be just a little bit more ambitious than everybody else, and then they pull it through. Like, everybody's known about multi-touch interfaces, but they've always thought it's just sort of too hard to pull off, or basically a full – you know, the biggest problem with a small device is how to fit a screen and a keyboard into the device. And merging those is brilliant because it means you need fewer keys because the key can morph. You know, different things can be different keys. And everybody always knew that, like, pushing keys on a flat screen with no feedback, with no visceral feeling that you've pushed the key, is a problem. And you might accidentally brush some buttons and stuff like that. And so everybody was just too scared to try to make a phone that was just a screen. They were just too scared, and they knew all the things that wouldn't work and all the problems that they would have. And Apple just was a little bit more ambitious, and they said, you know, to heck with it. Let's just try to make this thing work somehow. And they actually pulled it off. And they just tried to go, you know, 10% farther than anybody else even tries. Right. And so that's why it's kind of cool. What was the question anyway? What did that guy ask?
It was about just mobile platforms on phones. Another question? Let's do the next question.
All right, here's Lauren Norman.
Hey, Jeff and Joel. Great podcast. My name is Lauren Norman, and I'm a web entrepreneur and Ruby on Rails programmer in Atlanta, Georgia. Joel, for your RailsConf talk, I think you should address the subject of Ruby in the enterprise. There's a bit of a holy war going on for these fundamental Rubyists who shout, Ruby is so great, everyone should use it. Of course, no language or technology can inherently belong or not belong in the enterprise, but the fact is, it's just not instantly practical for a corporation with millions of dollars of infrastructure in Java or .NET to suddenly inject Ruby into the whole mess. So I think the real question is more along the lines of, how should a new language or technology go about entering the enterprise? You know, is there a responsible path, or perhaps it's a task-by-task judgment? Or maybe there are some things that should inherently be true of a language before it should be considered. So what are your thoughts, guys? And finally, my company blog is at snowcaplabs.com, and my personal blog is at laurennorman.com, neither of which is a cat blog. Thanks, guys.
No cats, and that's Lauren Norman, LaurenNorman.com. Go ahead.
Wait, let me open on that one. So the example of corporations that don't let Ruby into the infrastructure, Google is the perfect example, because Steve Yeagy has written extensively about how he really pushed for that, and their server farms just aren't able to accept Ruby for whatever reason. They have a lot of investment in their infrastructure. And so Google itself is a company that will not accept Ruby into their infrastructure, into their main server farms.
Didn't you just do a post about the speed of Ruby benchmarks and stuff like that? Is that you?
I did not.
I would guess if I were Google and I were operating, what are they operating, 200,000 servers? I just made that up. But yeah, on the six digits, so on that order, number of servers, I would guess it's probably pretty close to a million. That to use a language that is that whose current runtime performance is, let's even say, three or four times slower than another language that you're already using, that all of a sudden means that instead of 100,000 servers, you need 400,000. And maybe it's just one small app, but that actually, those hundreds, cost of those hundreds of thousands of servers start to add up, even if you're Google. So I know that everybody dismisses performance and says it's fast enough, but if you're really trying to scale something out, if you're trying to blow something out to 100 million people like Google does, performance does really, really matter again.
And plus, considering Google does use Python, I don't think, you can make the case, Ruby is, more dynamic and better than, say, C or something like that. But when you're comparing, Python to Ruby, I think it's a much less compelling case. I think if you're a really good Python developer, I don't think you're going to get that much out of Ruby. I dislike this magical bullet thing that programmers love magic bullets. There's always some new magical bullet every 5 years. And I think Ruby is this, and not that Ruby doesn't have a lot of cool things about it, because when Steve Yeagy, who's basically a student of languages, says he thinks Ruby's the best compromise of all the things you can have in a language, that means a lot to me.
He changes his mind a lot. Now he's big on JavaScript.
Well, by default, because because Google won't let him put Ruby on their infrastructure.
If he was allowed to put Ruby on their infrastructure, he would be calling for people to use OCaml. I guarantee it. No, but wait, I do want to say one thing here, which is you're absolutely right that Ruby doesn't buy you that much more than Python. It is a little bit cleaner. It's more forcefully object oriented. Python still has a lot of leftover functional, for example, to find the length of a string, you call the len function and you put the string in parentheses. And in Ruby, it's just a method calling the string. And so that's just sort of a slight wart on the Python language that Ruby doesn't have. But other than that, they're pretty dang darn close of the types of things you can express and how you express them. But this is sort of a question, because the question was, if you're a language, how would you get yourself accepted in the enterprise? And so I want to know, who cares? Why? Why? First of all, a language is a language. It's not a person. Why? It doesn't have its own agenda.
Right.
It's just a language in which you go. We're talking about people here. And if it's people, I think what he's really saying is, let's say you love Ruby and you want to get your enterprise to start using Ruby because you love it. And that's okay too, but what's your agenda here? Is it to get Ruby adopted at all costs, or is it to solve the business problems that you're supposed to be solving? Ooh, this brings us back full circle to the suckage of working in the enterprise as a developer, where you always have to do things in the non-optimal way, and you have to use the programming language that everybody understands and that everybody's comfortable with, and you try to use a better programming language and they laugh at you. And
there's an advisory
board. Good Lord, and they're always trying to standardize on some language, and by the time they standardize on it, it's obsolete and not fun anymore.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, having worked for large and small companies as a developer, there are pathologies of both. But I will say, working at a small company, you get a lot of flexibility, and that can be worth a lot of big company benefits.
I don't really know why Ruby wants to be in the enterprise. Yeah. Leave it alone. But some of them don't. Some of them do. And honestly, it's like, you know, when it's the right tool for the task, people will start to adopt it. And honestly, the enterprise people are going to be the last people to adopt it because they're going to be very conservative. And the 22-year-old Y Combinator startups are going to be the first people to adopt it because they're 22 and they can do whatever they want.
Right. And also, you know, have some time perspective. I think in the computer, the software industry, we forget that some of this stuff does take actual time because we're so used to, you know, everything happening instantly that you forget that JavaScript is like barely a teenager in the chronological time that it's been out. So some of the stuff just takes, you know, pure time. And I think Ruby dates from like 95, so it's about a similar age. But I think had a much slower adoption curve, obviously, because nobody had heard of Ruby until, 4 years ago? whereas JavaScript was kind of – people had heard about it in 99. So I think you got to be – you got to have some patience and have some context in the industry at large about the clock time it takes for stuff to become mainstream enough for –
Yeah, even just for the language to be good enough to use for – suitable for lots of tasks.
Maturity.
Even Java, which was a spectacular success, spent a few years in the woods as an internal project at Sun called Oak, which never really saw the light of day for what it was intended, which was for a language for programming set-top boxes, which everybody was all excited about in the early 90s for making this information superhighway thing that everybody was trying to make. And suddenly they needed a language for the internet. And they looked around and they had this, and so it popped out with ridiculously good PR, absolutely spectacular take up, and it was one of the fastest language adoptions you've ever seen. Even Visual Basic, geez, it went through many versions before it could even talk to databases. I remember specifically Visual Basic 3.0 was the first version that could talk to a database, and at that point it suddenly actually became useful for anything other than toys. And you know, that's even Visual Basic, which became very popular in the enterprise, took a long time to become kind of acceptable there.
I like your point too, that the question was kind of backwards. It's like, well, the question should be, how can I build something awesome, not how can I use language X? And if the answer to how can I build something awesome is, well,
yeah, more power to you,
X, then that's fine. But in some ways, the question is really backwards, and I think that's a good, very good thing to.
It's kind of weird. It's this sort of partisan, like evangelical assumption of like, how do I evangelize my language, or how do I get other people to be excited about it and use it and want to use it, and thus remove some of that doubt that I keep feeling every time I notice that I'm the only person on my team that wants to use Ruby. Everybody else is happy just continuing to use enterprise Java beans. They're using blob. Paul Graham.
Yes. The general catch-all term for your language sucks is blob.
Okay, well, that's we've gone about an hour. Did we say anything racist, sexist, offensive to Republicans or religious or anything like that that we're going to need to delete?
I don't think so. But of course, I didn't really listen to anything that was said, so I'll just have to find out.
You can delete that all later. Anyway, two things that I want to say. This is just sort of bookkeeping things. One is, I don't know if y'all know this, but we do have a transcript wiki. And that is in the early days of Stack Overflow, the podcast. We got a bunch of requests for to do something about the hearing impaired. And so What we did is we opened a transcript wiki to allow volunteers, listeners like you, to go in and contribute even just like a few minutes of transcripts of maybe their favorite part of the show or something that they want to get into words that Google can search or something that they want people to read. And it's actually been modestly successful. A lot of the shows have a lot of transcripts in there. So if you have a few spare minutes, if you want to contribute and volunteer, please check out the transcript wikis. They're located at stackoverflow.fogbugs.com. And there's a link.
Oh, and Joel, I can sweeten the pot. I can sweeten the pot just a little bit. I'm not really accepting anyone into the private beta anymore. But if you really desperately want to be in the private beta, just do some transcript work, just a couple minutes, and then it's on the honor system. Obviously, we're all
well. You can see who edited it in the wiki. It'll show you who edited it. So, yep, that's excellent. A bribe. Or just do it out of the goodness of your heart. Or if you think there's something that we said here that needs to be a part of the permanent record. That's real nice. And a lot of people have been contributing to the Transcript Wiki. And I want to thank them, especially Josh Paris. So what else? If you have any questions or suggestions, things you want to talk about, things you want us to talk about, things that you want to get on the air, things you want to promote that are interesting and will be interesting to our readers. Here's what you do. You have to record a little sound file so that we can play it. And it should be less than 90 seconds in MP3 or Ogg Vorbis format. Those are really the only two formats I've been able to figure out is MP3 and Ogg Vorbis. I wish I could figure out QuickTime Audio, but I can't find a converter right now. So like I say, try to get one of those two formats. And then what you do is you email them to podcast@stackoverflow.com, and hopefully we select the best ones to play every week and talk about. All right, that's about it.
Yep.
See you next week.
Okay, bye.
You've been listening to Stack Overflow with Jeff Atwood and Joel Spolsky.
The post-production audio engineer for this program was Joel Spolsky. Our website editor was Jeff Atwood. The series producer is Joel Cherney.
This is Phil Windley. I hope you'll join me next time for another great presentation from Stack Overflow here on IT Conversations.